This episode of the Ortho Bullets podcast will go over the topic of radial head fractures from the trauma section on orthobullets.com. Radial head fractures make up 1.5 to 4% of all fractures. Radial head fractures are among the most common elbow fractures, making up about 33% of all elbow fractures. With respect to the pathophysiology, the mechanism of injury for a radial head fracture is usually a fall on an outstretched hand. The elbow in extension plus the forearm in pronation causes the most force transmitted from the wrist to the radial head. Again, the elbow in extension plus the forearm in pronation causes the most force transmitted from the wrist to the radial head. With respect to associated injuries, 35% of radial head fractures have associated soft tissue or skeletal injuries, including ligamentous injury, Essex-Lopresti injury, other elbow fractures, elbow dislocations, and or carpal fractures. With respect to ligamentous injury, lateral collateral ligament or LCL injury is the most common, which is found on up to 80% of patients on MRI. You may also see medial collateral ligament or MCL injury and combined LCL/MCL injury. An Essex-Lopresti injury is a distal radial ulnar joint or DRUJ injury with interosseous membrane disruption. Other elbow fractures include coronoid fractures and olecranon fractures. Elbow dislocations are associated with the terrible triad of elbow dislocation, radial head fracture, and coronoid fracture. And finally, carpal fractures associated with radial head fractures are usually scaphoid fractures. Now, let's go over some relevant anatomy. Let's start with the osteology. The elbow joint contains two articulations, the ulnohumeral articulation, which is a hinge joint, and the radiocapitellar joint, which is a pivot joint. The radiocapitellar joint has approximately a 60% load transfer across the elbow joint. The proximal radius has a non-articular portion of the radial head, which is an approximately 90-degree arc from the radial styloid to Lister's tubercle, which is the safe zone for hardware placement. With respect to ligaments, let's talk about the lateral collateral ligament complex and the medial or ulnar collateral ligament, otherwise known as the MCL. The lateral collateral ligament complex contains the lateral ulnar collateral ligament, or the LUCL, the radial collateral ligament, or RCL, the accessory lateral collateral ligament, and the annular ligament. Remember that the lateral ulnar collateral ligament is the primary stabilizer to varus and external rotation stress, and deficiency results in posterolateral rotatory instability. And also remember that the annular ligament stabilizes the proximal radial ulnar joint. The medial ulnar collateral ligament, or the MCL, has three bundles: the anterior, posterior, and transverse bundles. The anterior bundle is the primary stabilizer to valgus stress, and the radial head is second. Moving on to biomechanics, the radial head confers two types of stability to the elbow: valgus stability and longitudinal stability. With respect to valgus stability, the radial head is the secondary restraint to valgus load at the elbow, and this is important if the MCL is deficient. With respect to longitudinal stability, the radial head is the restraint to proximal migration of the radius with contributions from the interosseous membrane and DRUJ. There is also load sharing from the wrist to radiocapitellar joint, dependent on the radiocapitellar surface area. Loss of longitudinal stability occurs when there is a radial head fracture plus a DRUJ injury plus interosseous membrane disruption, otherwise known as an Essex-Lopresti injury. In this setting, the radial head must be fixed or replaced to restore stability, preventing proximal migration of the radius as well as ulnocarpal impaction. With respect to classification of radial head fractures, the one to know is the Mason classification, which was modified by Hotchkiss and Broberg-Mori. And this classification is divided into four types. Type 1 is a non-displaced or minimally displaced fracture of the radial head, defined as less than 2 millimeters, and type 1 injuries have no mechanical block to rotation. Type 2 injuries are displaced greater than 2 millimeters or angulated with possible mechanical block to forearm rotation. Type 3 injuries are comminuted and displaced with mechanical block to motion. And type 4 injuries are radial head fractures with an associated elbow dislocation. With respect to the presentation of patients with radial head fractures, symptoms include pain and tenderness along the lateral aspect of the elbow, with limited elbow or forearm motion, particularly supination/pronation. Physical exam should focus on evaluating range of motion and stability. As far as range of motion, evaluate for mechanical blocks to elbow motion, specifically flexion/extension and pronation/supination. Remember that an aspiration of joint hematoma and injection of local anesthesia aids in evaluation of mechanical block. Stability of the elbow can be evaluated with a lateral pivot shift test, which tests the LUCL, and a valgus stress test, which tests the MCL. With respect to the DRUJ, palpate the wrist for tenderness and translation in the sagittal plane of greater than 50% compared to the contralateral side is abnormal. However, this may be difficult to determine on exam, so you can get a dynamic CT scan in neutral, pronation, and supination for more subtle injuries. With respect to the interosseous membrane, palpate along the interosseous membrane for tenderness, and you can also use the radius pull test, in which greater than 3 millimeters of translation is concerning for longitudinal forearm instability or an Essex-Lopresti lesion. Recommended views for radiographs of radial head fractures include an AP and lateral of the elbow, and make sure to check for a fat pad sign indicating occult minimally displaced fractures. Additional views include a radiocapitellar view or a Greenspan view, which is an oblique lateral view of the elbow with the beam angled 45 degrees cephalad, allowing visualization of the radial head without coronoid overlap. This helps detect subtle fractures of the radial head. CT further delineates fragments in comminuted fractures and helps identify associated injuries in complex fracture dislocations. Treatment of radial head fractures can be operative or non-operative. Non-operative management includes short periods of immobilization followed by early range of motion. Indications include isolated, minimally displaced fractures with no mechanical blocks, like in Mason type 1 injuries. As far as outcomes, you have to watch out for elbow stiffness with prolonged immobilization. However, there are good results in 85% to 95% of patients. Operative options include ORIF, fragment excision or partial excision, radial head resection or a complete excision, radial head arthroplasty, or retrograde titanium nail reduction and stabilization. Indications for ORIF include Mason type 2 injuries with mechanical block, Mason type 3 injuries where ORIF is feasible, and presence of other complex ipsilateral elbow injuries. With respect to outcomes, the number of fragments is an important consideration. For example, ORIF has been shown to have worse outcomes with 3 or more fragments compared to ORIF with less than 3 fragments. Isolated versus complex is another important consideration. For example, ORIF in isolated radial head fractures versus complex radial head fractures for other associated fractures/dislocations show no significant difference in outcomes at 4 years. And isolated fractures trended towards better patient-rated elbow evaluation scores, lower complication rates, and lower rates of secondary capsular release. Fragment excision or partial excision is indicated for fragments less than 25% of the surface area of the radial head or 25% to 33% of the capitellar surface area. With respect to outcomes, even small fragment excisions may lead to instability. Radial head resection or complete excision is indicated for low-demand sedentary patients as well as in a delayed setting for continued pain of an isolated radial head fracture. Contraindications include presence of destabilizing injuries, forearm interosseous ligament injury that is greater than 3 millimeters translation with the radius pull test, coronoid fracture, and MCL deficiency. Radial head arthroplasty is indicated for comminuted fractures like Mason type 3 injuries with 3 or more fragments where ORIF is not feasible and involves greater than 25% of the radial head. Other indications include elbow fracture dislocations or Essex-Lopresti lesions. Radial head excision will exacerbate elbow/wrist instability and may result in proximal radial migration and ulnocarpal impingement. As far as outcomes, radial head fractures requiring replacement have shown good clinical outcomes with metallic implants. Compared to ORIF for fracture dislocations and Mason type 3 fractures, arthroplasty results in greater stability, lower complication rate, and higher patient satisfaction. Finally, a retrograde titanium nail reduction and stabilization is not yet considered mainstream treatment as it's in the pediatric population. With respect to outcomes, small-powered case studies do show good outcomes. As far as surgical techniques, let's go over approaches to the radial head. Remember that the PIN crosses the proximal radius from anterior to posterior within the supinator muscle 4 centimeters distal to the radial head. In both Coker and Kaplan approaches, the forearm should be pronated to protect the PIN. Pronation pulls the nerve anterior and away from the surgical field. The Coker approach is the interval between the ECU, which is innervated by the PIN, and the Anconius, which is innervated by the radial nerve. Key steps include incising the posterior fibers of the supinator and incising the capsule in the mid-radial capitellar plane, anterior to the crista supinatoris, to avoid damaging the LUCL. The pros of this approach is that there is less risk of PIN injury than in the Kaplan approach, which is more posterior. The cons of the Coker approach is that you risk destabilizing the elbow if the capsule incision is too posterior and the LUCL is violated, which lies below the equator of the capitellum. The Kaplan approach uses the interval between the EDC, which is innervated by the PIN, and the ECRB, which is innervated by the radial nerve. Key steps include incising the mid-fibers of the supinator and incising the capsule anterior to the mid-radial capitellar plane to have access. Pros include less risk of disrupting the LUCL and destabilizing the elbow than the Coker approach, which is more anterior. Another pro of the Kaplan approach is better visualization of the coronoid. Cons include greater risk of PIN and radial nerve injury. With respect to ORIF, you can use either a Coker or Kaplan approach. You can use plates for fractures involving the head and neck, and with respect to posterolateral plate placement, this will be in the safe zone as it's a non-articular area that consists of a 90 to 110 degree arc from the radial styloid to Lister's tubercle with the arm in neutral rotation to avoid impingement of the ulna with forearm rotation. The bicipital tuberosity is the distal limit of plate placement. Anything distal to that will endanger the PIN. Finally, make sure to countersink implants on the articular surface. With respect to screws, headless compression screws or Herbert screws should be used if placed in the articular surface. Use of screws alone have better elbow range of motion and functional outcome scores at 1 year compared to plate fixation. With respect to radial head resection, again, the approach is either a Coker or Kaplan approach. Complications after excision of the radial head include muscle weakness, wrist pain, valgus elbow instability, heterotopic ossification, arthritis, proximal radial migration, decreased strength, and or cubitus valgus. Moving on to radial head arthroplasty, you can also use the Coker or Kaplan approach for this procedure. The technique can use a metal prosthesis, whether a loose-stemmed prosthesis that acts as a stiff spacer, or a bipolar prosthesis that is cemented into the neck of the radius. Silicone implants are no longer used and is actually an independent risk factor for revision surgery. Complications of radial head arthroplasty is overstuffing of the joint that leads to capitellar wear problems and malalignment instability. Overstuffing of the joint is best assessed under direct visualization. Now, let's finish this review session talking about some surgical complications, like displacement of the fracture, posterior interosseous nerve injury with operative management, loss of fixation, loss of forearm rotation, elbow stiffness, radial capitellar joint arthritis, infection, heterotopic ossification, hardware loosening, and or complex regional pain syndrome. With respect to displacement of the fracture, this occurs in less than 5% of fractures. Serial radiographs do not change management. And with respect to elbow stiffness, the first-line management includes supervised exercise therapy with static or dynamic progressive elbow splinting over a 6-month period. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. First question: which of the following structures may help maintain radial length after a radial head fracture? And the choices are 1, triangular fibrocartilage complex; 2, medial ulnar collateral ligament; 3, lateral ulnar collateral ligament; 4, annular ligament; and 5, coronoid. So Essex Lopresti injuries affect axial stability of the forearm. An injury to the interosseous membrane or the triangular fibrocartilage complex can result in proximal migration of the radius. So the correct answer to this question is 1, the triangular fibrocartilage complex is the structure that may help maintain radial length after a radial head fracture. Moving on to the next question. A 37-year-old man with a non-displaced radial neck fracture has failed to respond to 8 months of non-surgical treatment. He has undergone extensive physical therapy and bracing without improvement. Examination reveals that active and passive range of motion is limited to 50 degrees to 85 degrees with full pronosupination. He has mildly diminished sensation in the little and ring fingers. Radiographs reveal healing of the fracture, no deformity, and no arthrosis or heterotopic bone formation. What is the most appropriate management? And the choices are 1, radial head resection and release of the anterior capsule; 2, anterior and posterior capsule release with ulnar nerve transposition. 3, ulnar nerve transposition and release of the posterior capsule. 4, ulnar nerve transposition. And 5, intra-articular corticosteroid injection. So the patient has refractory extra-articular elbow stiffness and ulnar neuritis following trauma. Important considerations are ruling out failure of fracture healing, persistent deformity, and heterotopic bone formation. In this patient, further non-surgical management is unlikely to provide any benefit. Therefore, the treatment of choice is anterior and posterior capsular release with ulnar nerve transposition, making 2 the correct answer to this question. Radial head resection is not indicated because of the absence of deformity or arthrosis. There is restriction of both flexion and extension, so limited capsular release techniques will not maximize functional restoration. Ulnar nerve transposition alone will not restore motion, and an intra-articular injection is not likely to improve motion 8 months after the injury. Moving on to the next question. In patients with displaced radial neck fractures treated with open reduction and internal fixation with a plate and screws, the plate must be limited to what surface of the radius to avoid impingement on the proximal ulna? And the choices are 1, 2 centimeters distal to the articular surface of the radial head, 2, 1 centimeter distal to the articular surface of the radial head, 3, within a 90-degree arc or safe zone, 4, within a 120-degree arc or safe zone, and 5, within a 180-degree arc or safe zone. So the radial head is covered by cartilage on 360 degrees of its circumference. However, with the normal range of forearm rotation of 160 to 180 degrees, there is a consistent area that is non-articulating. This area is found by palpation of the radial styloid and Lister's tubercle. The hardware should be kept within a 90-degree arc on the radial head, subtended by these two structures. So the correct answer to this question is 3, within a 90-degree arc or safe zone. Moving on to the next question. A 57-year-old woman sustains a posterolateral elbow dislocation. Following close reduction, a displaced radial head fracture of 40% of the joint surface is noted. At surgery, the fragment is found to be comminuted into 4 pieces. What is the best choice for treatment? And the choices are 1, partial radial head excision, 2, radial head excision, 3, radial head replacement, 4, total elbow arthroplasty, and 5, open reduction and internal fixation with prolonged postoperative immobilization. So the injury described is a ligamentous injury because of the dislocation with the radial head fracture. Therefore, the surgical goals are to restore stability to the elbow and allow early range of motion. Only radial head replacement will restore stability and allow early range of motion of the elbow. Radial head excision is not recommended in the setting of any instability because the radiocapitellar joint is an important secondary stabilizer of the elbow. Total elbow arthroplasty is not needed because the ulnohumeral joint is normal. Partial excision of fragments over 30% will likely cause degeneration of the capitellum and will not restore the secondary stabilizing effect of the radial head. Attempts to repair the radial head that cannot achieve rigid fixation are not recommended because they do not restore stability or allow early range of motion. So the correct answer to this question is 3, radial head replacement. Moving on to the next question. What is the best indication for prosthetic radial head arthroplasty following fracture? And the choices are 1, Mason type 1 fracture with full range of motion, 2, Mason type 1 fracture with decreased supination, 3, Mason type 1 fracture with decreased pronation, 4, Mason type 3 fracture with associated interosseous membrane injury, and 5, Mason type 3 fracture with associated interosseous membrane disruption. So the Mason classification differentiates the degree of displacement, angulation, and mechanical block to motion. Most non-displaced radial head fractures that are Mason type 1, in which there is no block to motion, can be treated non-surgically. Mason type 3 injuries are severely comminuted radial head fractures. Fragment excision can be considered in unreconstructable fractures in which the interosseous membrane is intact. However, if the interosseous membrane has been disrupted, fragment excision can lead to proximal migration of the radius with associated wrist problems. In this case, radial head arthroplasty is indicated. Radial head arthroplasty may also be required when the radial head fracture is associated with other ligamentous injuries as seen following an elbow dislocation or with an associated unstable coronoid fracture. So the correct answer to this question is 4, Mason type 3 fracture with associated interosseous membrane injury. Moving on to the next question. A patient has an elbow injury that includes a coronoid fracture, medial collateral ligament injury, and a radial head fracture. When is excision of the radial head without replacement indicated as definitive treatment for the radial head injury? And the choices are 1, when the elbow is stable after fixation of the coronoid and medial collateral ligament, 2, when the elbow is unstable after fixation of the coronoid and medial collateral ligament, 3, when the fracture is comminuted and therefore stable internal fixation is unobtainable, 4, when there is pre-existing radiocapitellar arthritis, and 5, excision is generally not indicated in this clinical scenario. So the injury in this question likely represents a terrible triad injury. Restoration of the lateral column is required to restore valgus stability. A repaired or replaced radial head is also thought to be protective of the coronoid fracture repair. Therefore, excision is not indicated. Either radial head arthroplasty or open reduction and internal fixation would be indicated. So the correct answer to this question is 5. Excision is generally not indicated in this clinical scenario. Moving on to the next question. What is the best way to determine whether a radial head implant is too thick intraoperatively? And the choices are 1. Visually assess the radiocapitellar joint. 2. Visually assess widening of the lateral ulnar humeral joint. 3. Assess widening of the radiocapitellar joint on an AP radiograph. 4. Assess the elbow for concentric reduction on a lateral radiograph. And 5. Assess widening of the medial ulnar humeral joint on an AP radiograph. So widening of the medial ulnar humeral joint on an AP radiograph is only visible after over-lengthening of the radial head by 6 millimeters or more. At least in a cadaver study, the most sensitive method was to visually assess the lateral aspect of the ulnar humeral joint with the radial head resected and then with the trial radial head in place. This method allows detection of any over-lengthening. So the correct answer to this question is 2. Visually assess widening of the lateral ulnar humeral joint. Moving on to the next question. A healthy 39-year-old male presents to clinic with post-traumatic elbow stiffness after a minimally displaced radial head fracture. His injury occurred 4 months ago with no improvement in range of motion despite 10 weeks of supervised physiotherapy. Follow-up radiographs reveal normal osseous anatomy. What is the next best step in treatment? And the choices are 1. Intra-articular and extracapsular cortisone injection, 2. Closed manipulation under anesthesia, 3. Aggressive home exercise program, 4. Continuous passive motion device, and 5. Static or dynamic progressive elbow splinting. So supervised exercise therapy with static or dynamic progressive elbow splinting over a 6-month period has shown to have the greatest improvement on DASH scores and functional range of motion in patients with post-traumatic elbow stiffness. So the correct answer to this question is 5. Static or dynamic progressive elbow splinting is the next best step in treatment. The goal of treatment in post-traumatic stiffness is to restore a functional range of motion that is between 30 degrees to 130 degrees. Non-operative modalities are considered the first line of treatment. Aggressive physical therapy has traditionally been advocated. However, the use of static or dynamic progressive elbow splinting with a turnbuckle has shown to provide better functional outcomes. Treatment is usually maintained over a period of 6 to 12 months. Surgery is considered when non-operative therapy fails. Galinas et al. Treated 22 patients with an elbow contracture using a static progressive turnbuckle splint for a mean of 4.5 plus or minus 1.8 months. The mean range of motion improved from between 32 to 108 to between 26 to 127 degrees with a p-value of 0.0001. The results suggest that static progressive splinting is an effective modality for postoperative elbow stiffness. Lyndon Hovius et al. Randomized 66 patients with post-traumatic elbow stiffness into static progressive elbow splint therapy or dynamic elbow splinting over a 12-month period. There was no significant difference in outcomes between the treatment modalities. Range of motion increased by 40 degrees versus 39 degrees at 6 months respectively. DASH scores improved from 50 versus 45 at enrollment to 32 versus 25 at 6 months respectively. Moving on to the next question. A 51-year-old female sustained a comminuted radial head fracture with 4 fragments and an associated elbow dislocation. She was initially closed-reduced and splinted with the elbow joint in a reduced position and presented to the orthopedist's office 10 days later. In response to the patient's question of what treatment offers the best chance for a good outcome, the surgeon should recommend, and the choices are 1. Excision of the radial head, 2 ORIF of the radial head, 3 continued splinting and no surgery, 4 radial head arthroplasty, and 5 hinged external fixation. So in the context of elbow instability, optimal treatment of a comminuted radial head fracture with greater than 3 fragments is with a radial head replacement, making 4 the correct answer to this question. Again, radial head fractures are often seen in conjunction with injuries such as elbow dislocations and DRUJ instability. Although minimally displaced injuries can be treated non-operatively, an ORIF can be utilized when there is limited comminution of the radial head. Improved outcomes are demonstrated when radial head arthroplasty is used in the setting of greater than 3 fracture fragments. Ring et al. Reviewed 56 patients who had been treated with an ORIF of the radial head at 48 months after injury. They found that patients had unsatisfactory outcomes for patients who had an ORIF of radial fractures with greater than 3 articular fragments. They recommended ORIF of radial head fractures with 3 or fewer fragments. Morrow et al. Reviewed functional outcomes of patients treated with radial head arthroplasty for unreconstructable fractures. They found that patients treated with metal radial head implants had only mild physical impairment. Short-term follow-up indicates that radial head arthroplasty is a reasonable option for severely comminuted radial head fractures. Moving on to the next question. When performing a Coker approach to the radial head for open reduction internal fixation, the forearm is held in pronation. What structure is this maneuver attempting to protect? And the choices are 1. Median nerve, 2. Brachial artery, 3. Anterior interosseous nerve, 4. Radial nerve, and 5. Posterior interosseous nerve. So Dilberti et al. Quantified the dimensions of a surgical safe zone with respect to the posterior interosseous nerve when using the posterolateral approach to the radial head between the anconeus and the extensor carpi ulnaris. They found that the safe zone increased with pronation and decreased with supination. So the correct answer to this question is 5. The posterior interosseous nerve is a structure that pronation is trying to protect in a traditional Coker approach. Moving on to the next question. What is the most common complication following surgery for a terrible triad elbow fracture dislocation? And the choices are 1. Arthritis, 2. Infection, 3. Redislocation, 4. Restricted range of elbow motion, and 5. Posterior interosseous nerve palsy. So recurrent instability, PIN palsy, infection, and post-traumatic arthritis have all been reported following these injuries. However, elbow contracture or loss of motion is nearly universal following these injuries. So the correct answer to this question is 4. Restricted range of elbow motion is the most common complication following surgery for a terrible triad elbow fracture dislocation. And the final question for this topic. A patient undergoes open reduction and internal fixation of a displaced radial neck fracture. What position should the forearm be in during the approach and during fixation? And the choices are 1. Supinated during the approach and neutral for plate application. 2. Neutral during the approach and pronated for plate application. 3. Pronated during the approach and neutral for plate application. 4. Pronated during the approach and pronated for plate application. And 5. Pronated during the approach and supinated for plate application. So again, this question is similar to one that we recently just did. So pronating the forearm during the surgical approach decreases the danger to the posterior interosseous nerve by moving it away from the surgical field. Placing the plate straight lateral with the forearm in neutral rotation puts the plate in the safe zone that does not articulate with a proximal radial ulnar joint to prevent impingement of the plate during forearm rotation. So the correct answer to this question is 3. Pronated during the approach and neutral for plate application is the position that the forearm should be in during the approach and during fixation. That's all for this review about radial head fractures. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.